I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Kevin Young is a poet, professor, essayist, and editor. He's the former director of the Smithsonian Institution National Museum of African American History and Culture, and he's currently the poetry editor for The New Yorker. His new collection of poetry, titled Night Watch, was written over the course of 20 years and collectively examines loss and memory. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Kevin Young. How would you describe the theme of this collection?
Well, I think the theme varies in some ways, but it really is centered around loss, but also forms of remembering. And for me, place is a big part of the book. In a weird way, even though places aren't always named, though it starts with a poem, Cormorant, which is about that fascinating bird that's all over southern Louisiana, where my father's family's from. And it's a poem very much remembering him remembering. And one of the takeoff points of it is the ways that the cormorant is kind of like this considered lesser bird, and treated poorly in some ways, but has this regal nature. And I always found it fascinating, and it had something to do for me about that landscape. And then the other sections sort of get progressively longer. All Souls is a poem, I think, that's wrestling with issues of remembering, but also loss. There's a coyote in there. You got to have a coyote in the poem. And then you have a poem like Two-Headed Nightingale, which is longer still. And it's really returning to this idea of these two enslaved people, Millie and Christine McCoy, who were sisters, but they were also conjoined twins. What I was fascinated about them is they often refer to themselves as singular, and they say, I. And so the poem really is a philosophical meditation on what it means to be singular and plural at the same time. And along the way, because she was born enslaved and stolen then, and displayed as this sort of miracle of nature or a freak of nature, depending on how you viewed it. And she viewed herself as a miracle. And after she gets her freedom, she sings and tours Europe and is really feted. And I was really curious about this person who had this doubleness, especially at a time during the Civil War when the nation was divided, and in some ways feels a little bit like now in the kinds of divisions. And lastly, the last section is a long poem called Darkling, and it really riffs off Dante, and some of those same themes come to bear of loss and the dead, and how the dead are sort of animate our lives and are around us all the time.
You know, at the back of the collection is a list of dates, years along with a month or a season or a place. You know, my assumption is that these are the times and places, the when and where you wrote the poems. Did you have a theme in mind as you wrote, or does it present itself after you've accumulated a body of work?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's more a process of accumulation, or maybe of bursts. They kind of bloom again and again. And this book was started almost 20 years ago. So it wasn't a book then, of course, it was a bunch of poems. And there's a real big difference between a bunch of poems and a book. And finding its true form is the hardest thing about a book. And I like books to feel sort of differently. But a few years ago, I started adding in those composition dates, because they felt like kind of datelines in a story or some part of the poem that needed to be told. And looking back, because I don't always remember, I started this book really right after my father died, and I published other books that deal more directly with his death. But this kind of is in the spirit of that. And in a way, it was felt kind of dark. And so I put it in a drawer. And only during COVID and pandemic, when I was in Harlem, I pulled it out, and it felt just like, ready to go. Like, it felt like the moment we were in. And it kind of still does. Which is perhaps as much about the moment as anything else. But it also, for me, is about sort of that time that it takes to almost fulfill a prophecy, to get something seen and seen well. And there were other stops along the way, but that's kind of the big journey the book took.
You just mentioned this, but one of the sections, Darkling, is divided into subsections. In the first subsection, The Dark Wood, has an epigraph from Canto 1 of Dante's Inferno. And the following poems refer to the descent and to the various circles of hell. Can you talk to me about the inspiration for these poems?
Yeah, you know, I was circling this idea, like I said, after my father's death, but I really didn't have a form, or I don't want to say a voice, but almost a voice. And I believe it was 2017 when the Museum of Modern Art reached out to me to write poems in response to Robert Rauschenberg's illustrations for Dante's Inferno, which I didn't know he had done. And he did them by hearing the poem read to him, much how the poem was intended. Dante's poem is an oral poem, you know, and to hear them aloud, and then he would make a illustration for each canto, which I think is such a beautiful kind of flow in the moment, improvisational way to work. And so I set about kind of doing that myself, along with Robin Costa Lewis, as another poet. We divided hell in half. And, you know, I very much, it helped me figure out a form for these poems that were not poems yet. You know, they were sort of ideas for poems. And suddenly, in a burst, they came in the ways that you're talking about it. The Descent, Beyond is another poem. They're poems that really think about, you know, the Grove of Suicides, and that powerful part in Dante where he's in this grove and plucks a leaf off of one of the suicides who end up in this grove, and it's painful. And that kind of moment of metaphor, but also I think of empathy that Dante has, even if in his, you know, cosmology, they're among the damned, there's an amazing, you know, sympathy and empathy there that I want to write through and about. And Dante just gave me a, you know, sounding board. He was my Virgil in some way, leading me through these poems. And then I ended up, without telling anyone, continuing into Purgatory and into Paradise, which I call Werewolf Hill and Resurrection City. They're maybe not the paradise of Dante. There's not as much light, but in a way, they were trying to figure out what redemption looks like now.
I feel like I have a few questions about craft. Most of the poems in the collection are made up of three-line stanzas, many with the first and third line of each stanza left justified and the second line indented, although there were some, like Yellow Jacket and Altarpiece, where this is sometimes reversed. Sometimes they're tercets, sometimes couplets. Can you talk about this form?
Well, it's a form both influenced by Dante, like all of poetry pretty much in the West is, and also at the same time was influenced by some previous books of mine, including Brown and Stones, which were my last two books. And in Stones, I really sort of settled on this form of a tercets or three-line stanza with the indent. And it was a way of kind of keeping that beat going and moving through, in that case, very much a Louisiana landscape where both my parents are from, Louisiana, but also, you know, it's where all my relatives are buried in these two cemeteries. And so to sort of confront these two spaces in Stones, it seemed like a great way to think about form in this book. But I feel like it's a slightly different form in this one in terms of its ins and outs. It allows itself to sometimes have a couplet, single line, and really break itself up a little bit in ways that Dante, I think, also does. He's very strict in some sense in the numerical quality, which I always loved since I read Dante as a teenager. But I also love the way that he gives you a little bit of freedom in there. And, you know, I should say the cantos and the Divine Comedy I read was the Chiardi translation, which turned out to be the same translation that Rauschenberg had heard. So some of those lines came into the poem, especially later as I was going into Paradise. And so there was a way that I was trying to understand form, not just through Dante, but through these kind of translations, if you will, from Rauschenberg, Chiardi, childhood, memory, and then a little bit of the future.
Well, many of the poems follow this form. When one breaks form, it tends to stand out to me. And so I'm curious about the poem River of Lamentation. Can you talk about it?
Well, that one's sort of a very stark poem, and it kind of interrupts itself on purpose. I think that's how lamentation works, though perhaps not on purpose. And unfortunately, I've had cause to write a number of elegies, and you're always trying to get at the language of loss, which, as I say in one, poem in Darkling, you can only learn by living there. Like you can't learn it secondhand. And so that kind of irony of learning the dead through the living is throughout the book. And in that poem, River of Lamentation, it's sort of stark and stops and starts. But in a lot of the poems, I find there's this kind of reaching toward flight, whether that's the stars or birds or the bees that are in that poem specifically. So there's that tension, I think, between the long fuller line and the stopped abrupt line.
In some of the poems, there were mentions of Samuel Beckett, William Blake, Thomas Hardy, John Berryman. Do these writers serve as inspiration or influence for you?
Yeah, that's in the purgatory portion. I have been trying to write about them. That section starts with Keats, and he died looking out at the Spanish Steps, and I went and saw him, sort of paid homage to him. I mean, this was 20 years ago, and I was always struck by the tiny room, but also the view from his room. So it was both beautiful and what it must it be like to be dying and looking at both beauty and also know you're dying. I mean, he was well aware and wrote, I think, with this fever because of it. And there's also his death mask in there. And so I was always struck by what happens for me in the poem, which is look at it, not look at us. And that idea of this death mask, which is really for the living. And those other poets seem alive to me, Hardy, Blake is one of them. How do they kind of become Virgils in that portion of the poem, which of course is about ascent, in Dante's conception, this idea of this mountain that you're climbing up, the stair, if you will. And that was really haunting to me. And that just happened to be the name of the first Keats poem. So we were off to the races and thinking about, what would that ascent look like? And again, it's a different kind of flight that the book is interested in.
I listened to the finished audiobook while I read an advanced reader copy of the text, and for the most part, the two versions were identical. But I did notice at one point that some changes were made from the print
Oh,
version
no.
in the audio version. Many of these poems have been published in journals elsewhere before this
Sure.
collection. So is a poem ever complete?
That's a great question. I mean, I came to think that the poem was completed by the reader, not necessarily the writer. But for me, it's also more that the poem is carried in the body. And, it isn't just mine, it's this body of work, right? That the reader, the listener, hears and takes in and sometimes carries with them, you hope. And that's why poetry, I think, is so powerful. Transcendent, also subversive in some ways, and hard to pin down because it's yours once you memorize it, once you hear it and take it in. And, it's the highest compliment. Dante is writing an oral poem for you to carry with you. And someone like Rauschenberg took it and made art from it. And we've all done versions of that, I think. And for me, those changes, those little moments, partially that's improvisation and just, we all grow and change, and so do poems. But I also love how a poem won't change any of its words, and you come to it at the right moment suddenly, and it's totally different. There are poems that meant so much to me when I was younger, and then there are poems I didn't quite wasn't ready for. And that's true in the writing too. I don't think I could have written this book, even though I started it so long ago. And another moment before I finished it, because I had to kind of see it as not just my losses, not personal in some way, though I think it's deeply personal. It's not autobiographical necessarily, except for that first poem, which takes us on this journey into these other poems that I hope expand the idea of the self, of loss, but also of that future that I think Dante was interested in, that I know that the enslaved were interested in, and that their descendants, like myself, sing of so beautifully. And one of the other influences we haven't mentioned is the African American spirituals, which growing up hearing and imbibing and the gospel that springs out of them, I just was always struck by the way that they reimagined a world to be both a heaven on earth, but also a paradise just out of reach. But that also was sometimes a guide to getting the heck out of Dodge. And that kind of idea of place and transcendence, but also the afterlife that isn't kind of mythic, but really about one's self being made whole in the moment, in the song, and anticipating a freedom that you kind of sing into being. That's animated, I think, a lot of my work, if not all of it. But especially in this book, I see the ways that that trajectory is there in living color.
One reason I like to read and listen simultaneously, especially with poetry, and especially when the author is reading his or her own poetry, it's so I can hear how the poet intends for the poem to be read. I can hear cadence, I can pick up on meter, I can understand if I should read an enjambed sentence to the end of the line or to the punctuation mark. When it comes to audio versus print in poetry, is there a benefit to the reader over the audio listener or vice versa?
Well, I love this idea. That's wonderful that you did that. And, you know, it's one reason why, as the poetry editor of the New Yorker, I'm always thankful that one of the things the New Yorker does is they often include, if they can, always include the poet reading the poem, you know, and sometimes when the poet's no longer with us, we will have someone else do it. And I think that's really important to the way that you ingest poetry. You know, to me, it's kind of the end point of a poem is to hear it. Doesn't mean that I read poems out loud all the time. In fact, I probably don't. I have this inner ear, inner voice that I hear a lot. And not all the time, mind you. But, you know, when I'm reading poems, I can hear them audibly. And I think the trick is to, as a writer or a reader, to sort of carry that with you and also get that down. You know, I find that when you're trying to write a poem, the hardest thing is getting that music right. Then I think as a reader in all senses, you know, the one who reads your poem on the page, but also maybe hears it, I think those are really crucial tools, you know, and after a while, I think the visual and the oral are the same. And so you're really trying to capture that on the page. And then in the reading itself, try to kind of convey what a poem looks like. And, you know, sometimes it's great when someone says, "Oh, I didn't think your poem would look like that." But sometimes you want them to hear how it looks and have it look like it's supposed to sound. And so I don't have a preference. I just think that the way that one encounters a poem, there's no wrong way to do it. And the more, the better.
I did notice, because I was reading while listening, an enjambment in the middle of a word. It was unfulfilled. And if I remember right, it might have even been like unfull was on one line and filled was on the other. And it might have even gone from one stanza to the next. And I don't read enough poetry to know. Is this a common practice?
Yeah, no, probably not. It's just how I heard it. And sometimes, you know, like the editor in me wants to go back and fix all those, you know, little blue notes. But, you know, like Miles Davis says, it's not a mistake when I turn it into the music after it. And so I think it's important to not smooth out all those rough edges in a poem. One of the funnier things to those who've been in a poetry workshop or any kind of workshop is there was something where they had Emily Dickinson in a workshop and, you know, people correcting all her quirks and, you know, little things that are essential to understanding her, the dashes. And, you know, if you see her actual draft, sometimes there's like plus signs and all these markations that I think are meant for us to understand that music she's hearing in her head. So I try to let them in there, and, you know, maybe they go far sometimes, but I also, you should understand that reading a poem, hearing a poem, it isn't the record of an event. It's also an event. And Robert Lowell, who said that, was having us think about this idea of the poem should do something on the page. The occasion of the poem can't be something far from the poem. It has to be part of it. And for me, I always try to talk to my students or anyone who listens really about the enacting that a poem should do. And when a poem enacts a feeling like grief, say, it's one of the most powerful things on earth. And I really believe that, treasure that. And, poetry has saved me in so many ways. And I love to preach about its saving graces to others.
I did notice a device in your poetry, which, as you read the poem, for the most part served as a hard pause in the audio, except when it didn't. And that was an asterisk between the stanzas. Can you talk to me about this pause?
That in some poems it's sections, little sections, but especially in the penultimate poem, which is called Hereafter, it really is interrupting this form that's otherwise flowing. And I think it's because it's a poem that deals with a plane that's hit by lightning. And to write a poem that's really smooth about that would seem kind of strange. Now, it happens at a regular interval, so it's not as jagged as it might sound, but I really wanted it to have that quality, and also provide a kind of coda both to the book but also to that experience, which was, quite strange. I talk about it in the poem, and this idea that I think I say something like, maybe I can read it really quick. Would you
Oh,
mind?
that would be great.
You should know that after you ready to meet the far stony shore, it is not hope, but the strange fire of forgiveness that flares and fights there, not wanting to go, hoping only you'd said so long to all you knew, to the elms who also know what it means to be told you die and survive. So I wanted that kind of quality of the, what does it mean to be fated and then not fated, to feel like you are, in limbo, quite literally up in the air. And at the same time, then, I'm here with you, talking about it. So clearly survive, but it was kind of a way of witnessing, and the asterisks are just another way of highlighting that.
How should readers approach this collection? You know, one poem a day, all in one sitting, in the order that the poems are presented?
Well, it is a bit more ordered than some books of mine, even. But I tend to open a book in the middle and read like front and back. I read like a poet. So, however people want, I do think there's something about hearing them aloud, which I love about it. But a poem like Darkling, I don't know if you're meant to have it in one setting. It's meant to be somewhat epic in the way that Dante is, though it's half as many cantos, if you will. But the journey, I think, is the important thing, whether it's the journey from front to back of the book or diving into Darkling. And it's also okay to jump around. I mean, I think what's powerful about Dante is the way that people have taken the Inferno for their own, and people often don't even read the other sections. So I hope you can read the other sections of mine, but I also want people to feel like they're not on a linear journey, but more a musical one, and one that takes you through these places, spaces, ones that I think sometimes harmonize, but other times are dissonant. But that's part of the music I'm trying to create. There's also a coyote, so.
I'm guilty. I've only read Inferno. I still need to read the other two. Do you have a hope for what readers will take away from this collection?
Well, I hope they do take away hope from the collection in a way. I think that, whether it's that mailbox or, the image of my son climbing a tree, these small moments, I think, are what the extraordinary is made of. And I think that kind of idea of the miraculousness of the everyday was so important to me. And to me, that's where paradise lies. It doesn't lie in some external thing, or it doesn't lie in some notion that's far from Earth only. It also can lie here and within us. And I make it sound like it's a book of preachiness, but it isn't. It's really, I hope, a book of, as it ends with, a kind of rapture. And that rapturousness sometimes ends up being quite hard. It's hard to move about, and especially now when things can seem kind of despondent or divided or strange. I love that we still have language to try to help us understand that. And for me, that's what poems do. That's what nature does. There's a lot of nature in the book. but also this idea of the night watch, of keeping vigil, is important. And if there's something about that, about being vigilant, but not just against things, but toward what's possible and beauty, then I'd be happy.
Night Watch by Kevin Young was published by Knopf. And now, book reviewer Suzanne Perez looks at a novel that follows the inner world of a mid-level marketing executive.
Early on in Beatriz Serrano's cutting and satirical debut novel, Discontent, we learn that 30-something main character Marissa has already had it with corporate life. "The truth is, I don't know how to do anything, and I don't know how I got here," she says. "I suppose it was by perfecting the office game until everybody believed I was a great professional." Marissa has risen through the ranks at a successful advertising agency, but she hates her job and everyone at it. She spends most of her working hours either locked in her office, hiding from coworkers, or racing around in an attempt to look busy. What she really does, though, is pawn off any actual assignments to her personal assistant or the advertising students in her master's program class, so she can watch YouTube videos in her office or escape to her favorite art museum. At the museum, in a drug-induced buzz, Marissa contemplates the meaning of life while staring at paintings by Hieronymus Bosch. If this novel sounds a bit like Otessa Moshfegh's My Year of Rest and Relaxation, it's because it very much is. Both Moshfegh and Serrano explore the depths of millennial ennui, with characters who live lives of extreme privilege but battle relentless and, at times annoying, existential dread. Both authors also master the art of dark humor, with writing that deftly navigates the line between grim and hilarious. When mentors advise Marissa to fake it till you make it, she responds with her own version of the rule: fake it until people leave you alone. Discontent was written in Spanish and translated for English audiences by Mara Faye Lethem. Nothing is lost in translation here because Serrano's cutting wit, like the cheesiness of those inspirational office posters, transcends the boundaries of culture. When Marissa gripes about TED Talks that implore you to follow your dreams, or that boss who treats employees like teenage kids, "I believe in you. You can do hard things. I know you won't disappoint me," we are all nodding and rolling our eyes, no matter the language. Woven amid the office space narrative are enjoyable side characters who underscore the humor, if not the actual plot. Marissa's middle-aged parents call once a week, even though they have nothing to say. And her friend Elena jokes that she's had so much work done, she's filled with plastic. "I'm the Atlantic Ocean," she says. By the time Marissa is forced to face her worst corporate nightmare, an overnight team-building retreat, we tag along with morbid fascination to an isolated forest outside Madrid. That's where we can only assume the company paintball battle will not end well. Surrounded by overzealous bosses and coworkers, not to mention an excess of drugs, Marissa's carefully crafted office persona threatens to come undone. And the story's climax had me cringe laughing. This audacious paperback original is another small novel that packs a big punch. At fewer than 200 pages, you could almost read it over your lunch break. An extended one, of course. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
Discontent by Beatriz Serrano was published by Vintage. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen, Luann Stevens, and Carly Cooper. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia.
Maybe you already know about naked short selling. Maybe you've personally shorted stocks yourself. But do you know about the time short sellers ruined a Super Bowl, basically?
For me, I was a little late, but red flags went up like, what is going on? This is really scary.
At Planet Money, we get the story behind the money to explain how money works. Listen on the NPR app or wherever you get your podcasts.